Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out NHHCA.org. We are in the First Nation primary state, doing the show that's all about the First Nation presidential primary. Welcome in right now, Paul Steinhauser, on what's going to be a packed edition of the show today. Conversations with Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang, and Tom Steyer, all ahead in this week's edition of the program. But we're going to start, though, as we do this show here on Wednesday, with Bernie Sanders' health. And we were surprised, very surprised, to learn that the senator was hospitalized and had two stents placed in his heart after he was not feeling too well on Tuesday. And this obviously is going to take the senator off of the campaign trail here for an indefinite amount, according to the campaign. They have postponed some ads which were going to run in Iowa. What are your takeaways, Paul?
Yeah.
First and foremost, we hope for the best in regards to the senator's health.
But of course. Yeah. But this is going to feed the perception, you know, that is Bernie Sanders too old to be president? He just turned 78 last month. You know, Republicans are going to be harping on this now going forward. Age has been an issue for Sanders ever since he jumped into the race. But it's also an issue for Donald Trump, who's 72, and for Joe Biden, who's 76. Elizabeth Warren is 70. So we've got, you know, the top candidates in this race on both sides are all over the age of 70. But again, this will bring this, you know, this will make this more center to the race again into Sanders' campaign. Yeah, he'll be off for a number of days. The campaign's saying just a few days. We'll see if it extends a little longer, but everybody's hoping he'll be back before the next presidential debate in 2 weeks.
I've talked with a couple of healthcare professionals in the medical field about the particular situation that Bernie finds himself in, and of course they can't speak specifically to it because they're not treating him, but say that generally in these circumstances an individual will have to rest for about a week and then they will be back to, you know, what they were doing, perhaps a little bit longer than that. Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones singer, they had to postpone the start of the tour for several weeks and I think another couple weeks because of logistical reasons. He's 76, Bernie's 78. Mick was right back on stage and doing his thing. So I don't think that this necessarily is, you know, the end of the campaign, if you will, for Bernie Sanders. This is
not at all.
It's not like the old days where something like this were to take place. It would be, you know, something that was extremely significant. Not underplaying the significance, but I think that this is going to not keep Bernie from campaigning still.
Well, two things here. I like the comparison to Mick Jagger because both are very animated on the stage. Let me say that. I think they have that in common. The other thing is, I mean, in this day and age, medical procedures.
It's fascinating.
Not as big a deal as they were. I mean, think back in April. Yeah. Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado was about to jump into the race for the White House, postponed it because he had to have a prostate cancer procedure. And then when after a few weeks after that, and he got the thumbs up, he was in the race. So, yeah, I mean, it's very different now with the advancements in medical treatments than it was decades ago, Chris.
Campaign cash numbers. Bernie had a huge haul in the third
quarter.
Huge! $25.3 million. Yang had a significant number. Kamala Harris. All of the campaign cash we've seen so far indicate strengths for the candidates.
Yes and no. And remember, we're recording this on a Wednesday afternoon, so there may be plenty more numbers revealed by the time this program airs, either live or over the weekend. But yes, Bernie Sanders is the headline so far. $25.3 million in the third quarter, which is July through September. All of that obviously grassroots because he doesn't hold big dollar fundraisers with top dollar donors.
That's how you know when things are going good. When you don't even have to do it, the money just comes in. You don't have to do any sales. The money just comes in.
And I will say that two things. A, it's $7 million more than he grabbed in the second quarter, but B, it comes at a very opportune time because most polling over the last 2-3 weeks here in New Hampshire as well as nationally has indicated that Sanders has really slipped into third place, trailing by a good amount now behind Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. So this was some really good news he needed. It gave him a big pump up to kind of push back against the narrative that he's falling out of the race for the White House, or at least out of the battle for the top spot. Other numbers, Pete Buttigieg, the second highest number so far that we've seen, 19.1 million. That's a very good number for the South Bend, Indiana mayor, but not as good as the 24.3 million million he had in the second quarter when he led the field. The other numbers we've seen so far, $11.6 million for Senator Harris of California, which is kind of what she raised in the first quarter, $12 million there, and in the second quarter, $11.8 million. So slightly less, but pretty much, you know, steady for her. You mentioned Andrew Yang. He had $2.8 million in the second quarter. He more than tripled that, $10 million in the third quarter. And that's just further evidence, further proof that he's become a serious contender for the race for the White House. He's made the debate stage in every round so far, and his polling numbers are pretty good. And then the only other number, two other numbers we've seen, Cory Booker raised $6 million, thanks in part to getting over $2 million in the last 10 days when he had that, when he said if he couldn't raise $2 million, he would probably call it quits. And then finally, we were just talking about Michael Bennett. I think it's about $1.5 million for him. Not a lot of money, but he will march on.
Yeah, when you look at, when you look at where the candidates are in the polling, the fact that Bennett's number, I think it was like $2.1 million, not to nitpick, but you look at Booker's number at $6 million, considering where he is at the polling, I think that they're doing well, but they're not doing well enough to catapult them moving forward. Yang's number jumps out at you because, again, he raised $2.2 in the second quarter. He raises over $10 million in the third quarter, and that shows significant growth. And Harris, same thing, where she is looking to get upwards mobility. It's just not happening.
Yeah, it sounds like you just wrote off Cory Booker, but I disagree with you on that. And Bennett, no, Bennett's barely hanging on, let's be honest. I mean, that's not, whether it's $1.5 million or $2 million, he's not going to make the debate stages, let's be honest. And you saw in the release from his campaign, they were railing once again at the DNC. You may not like the rules. A lot of people don't like these rules the DNC is putting out, but these are the rules everybody's got to play by. I don't know what, you know, Michael Bennett's a serious man, and he's a good man. I just don't know what his path forward is. One other note here, though, the Republican National Committee and the Trump reelection campaign combined raised $125 million. That's a record. It's up about $20 million from what they raised in the second quarter. And they got a boost out of impeachment. Let's say the president may be impeached in a few months, but his campaign's racking in the money.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I'm Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, my conversation with Bernie Sanders from this past Monday. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Well, prior to being sidelined after heart procedure, and glad to hear that Bernie Sanders is going to be back on the campaign trail soon, and in fact going to be in the debate on October the 15th, according to his campaign. Prior to that, he was in New Hampshire this week, and that included a sit-down conversation with yours truly in Manchester. Sanders right now, of course, a Democratic candidate for president, winner of the 2016 New Hampshire primary. Senator Sanders, how are you?
I'm great.
Great. Appreciate you joining us for the show. I want to start with impeachment. And there seems to be, and I think there will be throughout the course of this campaign, two separate things going on. A focus on my part in the media and others, as it rightfully should, be on impeachment. And then voters don't really want to talk about it that much. They're more interested in issues. Let's talk first about the practicality of impeachment, particularly in regards to the Senate. From what you've seen so far, do you think that there is enough to move Senate Republicans towards conviction, and should that matter in the process?
Chris, I think it's premature to answer that, because I would hope that all senators, myself and Republicans and Democrats, listen to the evidence. I mean, what you're talking about is, in a sense, a jury trial. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to go into, if you're on jury duty, you don't want to say, oh, this guy's guilty, but you haven't heard the evidence. He's innocent, but I haven't heard the evidence. But this is what I would say. I hope very much that my Republican colleagues will go beyond short-term political gain. This is an enormously important issue. Impeachment is such a serious issue that I hope my Republican colleagues and Democratic colleagues will listen to the evidence, will listen to the evidence and reach a decision. And what I would urge Mitch McConnell to do is if the House impeaches Trump and articles of impeachment come over to the Senate, we have got to have a serious trial. We have to hear all the evidence, and then we have to cast our votes.
Should there be taken into account the individual, and that you have obviously the evidence which is presented, but you've called him the most corrupt president of modern times. You've said he's a racist and gone on down the list. So it gives you no pleasure to say that, but
I have said that.
So should that matter? Should there be just strictly the evidence, or
it is the evidence, Chris.
But even if he's the most corrupt president ever.
Well, it depends whether the corruption is impeachable. I am not a great fan of Donald Trump, to say the least. I mean, I have said many times, I think he's a pathological liar. I think he is corrupt. I think he is a racist. I think he is a sexist and a homophobe and a xenophobe and a religious bigot. But that does not necessarily raise to the level of impeachable offense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what every member of the Senate, including myself, has got to do is listen to the evidence. This is a trial. And it's not whether you like Trump or you don't. I don't like Trump. I think he's a terrible president. But I have got to listen to the evidence before I cast my vote. I think that is my constitutional responsibility, and that is what I intend to do.
And also, do you look at the will of the people as well and say this is an individual that was elected via our system and it has to be evidence-based because of that? He could be the most corrupt, but he was voted upon by individuals.
Well, no. I mean, impeachment is part of the Constitution, and
right.
The president was voted upon. I think the evidence is the issue. This is a trial, all right? The Senate will go to trial. There'll be people who will say he's not guilty of an impeachable offense. There'll be people arguing that he is. It's the function of the U.S. Senate to listen to all the evidence and cast what is the proper and appropriate vote based on the evidence.
I know how much you enjoy the horse race stuff, so we'll get to that right now. I led into it as opposed to starting off with it. What do you see as your standing right now, being both nationally and in New Hampshire? There's polls, and you are not the biggest fan of polls, and they indicate that perhaps it's a two-person race between Elizabeth Warren.
Well, was that the last poll? With the poll before it, may have been ahead by, 7 or 8 points?
And there's polls that say a whole bunch of different things. But how do you see and feel where
we're feeling great. Honestly, we're feeling great. Yesterday we did 3 meetings. I think we had well over 1,000 people out in Hanover. The turnouts are great. I think we have a great organization here in New Hampshire. We're knocking on a lot of doors. I don't think there's anybody who has more grassroots activist support than we do. And I am very confident that we're going to win here in New Hampshire.
Do you feel that there's perhaps an urgency of some sort amongst the media to write you off? You've talked about it before, you feel like there's a little more focus on the negative side of things with your campaign as opposed to the
Chris,
positive side.
Look, this is no great secret. I'm not revealing any great secret. We are taking on the entire system. That means we're taking on Trump and the Republican establishment. We're taking on the Democratic establishment. We're taking on Wall Street, the insurance companies, the drug companies, the fossil fuel industry, and the 1%. And the 1% owns the media. That does not mean to say that, you know, it's fake news or all that stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. But do I think that the corporate media is particularly sympathetic to Bernie Sanders' candidacy? No, I don't. So what? We'll live with that. That's nothing new. And we're going out. Again, bottom line here is that we have well over 1 million volunteers in every congressional district in this country. I think the issues that we are talking about, raising the minimum wage to a living wage, making public colleges and universities tuition-free, canceling student debt, I'll tell you this, Medicare for All, and the understanding that the current healthcare system is dysfunctional, where you have 87 million people uninsured or underinsured, while the healthcare industry made $100 billion in profits last year. And I'll tell you something else. This issue of climate change. I was just talking to somebody a moment ago and asked me about the difference between this campaign and last time. This time, people feel much more strongly
about
the fears of climate change. And I'm proud that we have introduced by far the most comprehensive and aggressive climate change proposal of any candidate for president, any candidate who has ever run for anything.
And a lot of it's grassroots as well. I mean, you'll see issues during the course of the campaign, as you well know, that are driven by special interests, and you'll get those questions at the town halls. But a lot of it is, you know, kids in schools, individuals that live close to the shoreline. Those people are interested in it, and that's what's driving it, which is
that
the way is change
absolutely
happens.
Absolutely right. People are seeing it. They're seeing it in their own communities. They're seeing it when you look at what happened, terrible destruction in the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, 2 years ago, the floods that you're seeing in Texas, which were unprecedented. That's what we're seeing right now. And what the scientists tell us is that unless we act boldly and transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, it only gets worse. And it's not just young people who see that. I think the American people increasingly understand that we have to take on the fossil fuel industry.
Do you feel as this campaign moves along, we're about 4.5 months out from Election Day, that there's going to be a returning of your voters from 2016 because of your reliability and consistency? Or do you feel like you have to go out and earn it again, so to speak? Like Andrew Yang, as an example, is a candidate that has been able to slice into your group a little bit. I have friends that are supporting Yang this time and were with you the last time. Do you feel that at the end of it, those people will come back? Or how do you go about bringing them back?
Chris, I mean, again, I'm running on my record as somebody who has stood up for the working class of this country and working families for his entire life. I've taken on every powerful special interest. I think the proposals that we're introducing in this campaign are the most comprehensive in terms of the needs of working families. And I'm confident not only that our proposals and our ideas will resonate with voters in New Hampshire and around this country, but the fact, again, that we have a strong grassroots movement. We spend a lot of time and money, frankly, with grassroots activists who are knocking on doors, making the phone calls, which is, in my view, how you end up winning elections.
Andrew Yang has pushed back on wealth taxes, and you have said and tweeted that there should not be billionaires. There's no reason for there to be billionaires. He says that money will find a way. So you and Elizabeth Warren and your plans to tax the wealthy will end up being circumvented by money popping up. What do you say to something like that?
What I say is that one of the issues that Congress does not talk about enough and media does not talk about enough, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, is the grotesque level of wealth and income inequality that exists in America. I think it is unacceptable that three people own more wealth than the bottom half of American society. Now you tell me, Mr. Media Guy, how often do we discuss this in the media?
Well, I talk about it a lot because I think it's one of the issues that's driven your rise and Donald Trump's
rise.
But above
and beyond
well,
me, and yeah. I do talk about it. Yeah. Do you see it on TV very much?
No, but as I think it gets back to what you were describing before, there's certain topics that you have brought up which are very, very important that are uncomfortable. And people don't like to talk about uncomfortable things. And I think we're seeing it more and more with my generation and a little bit younger, kind of tired of that. Like, we want to have uncomfortable conversations, and that's one of the key parts of your success, in my view, is you break things up that are uncomfortable for people.
Well, it's not uncomfortable for people. It's
uncomfortable to talk about.
Uncomfortable, but it's also uncomfortable for the corporate elite.
Mm-hmm.
All right? They're not happy. I just introduced something yesterday that says, you know what, maybe it's a little bit absurd that we have CEOs in this country who make 1,000 times more than the median income of their workers. So maybe that's really wrong and not what America should be about. So we are raising issues, and that's why I think we're going to win. We're raising issues that are not often discussed. Healthcare is a human right. You know what? That is what I believe. That is what most Americans believe. That is not what the healthcare industry believes that made $100 billion in profit last year. I believe that when you're sick, you should be able to afford the medicine that your doctors prescribe. 1 out of 5 Americans can't do that. You know why? Because not only the greed, but the corruption and price fixing that goes on in the pharmaceutical industry. How often do we talk about that?
Not enough, and because I think that's one of the driving issues, and we'll conclude with that. I was down in D.C. last week, and both sides agree that prescription drug costs are too high and something needs to be done, but both sides remain hesitant to think that something is actually going to happen, particularly now in the light of impeachment. How is it that individuals are elected to go down to D.C. and don't do the work of the American people? And how would you as president, because if you are elected, it will be divisive. Anybody who's going to be elected is going to be divisive, but just because of where our nation is. How will you go about making sure that people do the work that individuals sent them down to do?
Because I will lead an administration that will be working for working families and not for wealthy campaign contributors. And I'm proud, as I mentioned earlier, to have received more individual contributors, more contributions, and from more individuals than any candidate in the history of the United States. And these are working class people. And I think our average donation, I don't know what it is, $18. All right. So I don't sit around with rich people in their living rooms. I don't have a super PAC. We're focused on the needs of working class people. And by the way, once you do that, once you talk to the needs of the middle class and working families, you find there's less division than you would think. Am I prepared to take on the greed and corruption of the pharmaceutical industry? I can't wait to begin to do that. These people are killing people, literally, because they're charging outrageous prices. They're involved in collusion. They're involved in price fixing. I will have an attorney general who is prepared to take them on. And by the way, under my Medicare for All single-payer plan, nobody in America pays more than $200 for the prescription drugs they need. That is what a humane and rational healthcare system is about.
Actually, one more thing briefly. I was reading about your bio and your upbringing, and you sit here right now as one of the most famous individuals in the world. And you have consistently championed the cause of lower working class individuals. And I'm curious, at what point in your life you started to realize this was your passion and your mission? And could you ever have imagined being here now as the person you are?
My parents were alive, and obviously they're long dead. They would never believe that somebody growing up in a rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn, New York, in a family that had no money, would ever be a United States senator running for president of the United States. And essentially, my upbringing, growing up in a rent-controlled apartment in a family that lived paycheck to paycheck, that is primarily what has influenced my political views. And it brought me to a sense of justice, that it is just unfair that so many people in our country today, half of our people, are living paycheck to paycheck, people working two jobs, three jobs, and yet you got three people owning more wealth than the bottom half of the American society. That's wrong, and as president, I will do something about that.
Was there a particular point, though, in your life where it just hit you?
Without going into it, many, many points of living in a family that did not have enough money. Trust me, I learned a lot about economics within that context.
Bernie, great to see you. Look forward to talking again soon.
Hey, good to be with you, Chris.
That is Bernie Sanders. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Andrew Yang joined me inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio on Main Street here in Concord. And here is that conversation. Appreciate you joining us for the show. So we'll start with impeachment and, you know, your thoughts on that. And is this something that's obviously changing on a day-in, day-out basis? The Washington Post story about the 2017 meeting in the Oval Office between the president and Russian officials and, you know, dismissing what had taken place in regards to election interference, saying that the United States partakes in that type of thing, so it's not a big deal. Where do you see this headed, and do you think that the president is, in fact, going to be impeached and convicted, or do you think that Republicans are not going to have the will to do that?
I believe Nancy Pelosi was right to move forward on impeachment proceedings. You can't have a president withholding aid from and putting pressure on foreign leaders for his own political gain against a rival and then suppressing the investigation. But I don't want us to have any illusions about a couple of things. One, it's unlikely to successfully impeach the president fully or get him out of office, I should say, because you would need 20 Senate Republicans to go along with that, and right now there does not seem to be any indication that's going to happen. And the second big thing that had me hesitant on the whole process was that any moment we spend talking about Donald Trump, even if it's impeaching Donald Trump, is a victory for Donald Trump. And what we need to do is present a new vision for the country that people can get excited about, that people can see ourselves in. And that's what my campaign's about. And that's how I think we can solve the problems that got Donald Trump elected in the first place and move the country forward in 2020.
I think that's a really good point, because two things are going to happen moving forward. The media and folks like myself are going to ask and talk a lot about impeachment. But folks at your events, and individuals who are interested in the primary process don't want to hear you talking about impeachment and are going to become disinterested with the process to a large degree of impeachment and want to hear about issues. If Democrats become the party of impeaching Donald Trump versus the party of ideas, that's where it becomes problematic. And plus, the field may also freeze if you know, there is an intense media focus on what's going on just with the impeachment process. And it'll be difficult on candidates like yourself or other candidates that are not in the top to kind of get any oxygen, correct?
Yeah, those are real concerns, it's understandable that the media would be fixated on impeachment, but I just met with 100 New Hampshire voters right now, took a whole series of questions. Not one asked me about impeachment.
Yeah, and that's not surprising.
Yeah, I agree, I appreciated that because, you know, they're not really thinking about impeachment top of mind.
So, in terms of the impeachment process, as you referenced, you're not optimistic about the chances of him being removed from office. So do you feel that that your focus and other candidates' focus is, and kind of getting back to what the individuals were saying at the meeting, do you feel that there needs to be a kind of a feeling and philosophy amongst the candidates that we're going to focus on issues and the impeachment process is going to take place on the Hill? Because so far it's been which candidate's going to talk about, you know, impeachment the most and which candidate's going to, because there's been a chasing of the headlines, which has existed during the course of this campaign so far.
I fully expect Donald Trump to be there in 2020 for me to defeat at the ballot box.
Yes.
And to me, there's been a lot of confusion among Democrats as to why Donald Trump won in the first place. People in New Hampshire, if you didn't vote for Donald Trump, you know people who did, your
right.
friends and neighbors. There's this frustration with our government not actually solving the problems of this time. And there's a depletion of our rural areas and main streets. 30% of stores and malls are closing because of Amazon, and Amazon's paying zero in taxes back into the system. The reason why Donald Trump won in 2016 is largely that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, all the swing states. And now that fourth industrial revolution is migrating from manufacturing to retail, call centers, fast food workers, and eventually truck drivers and taxi drivers. So this is the true set of problems that we need to get in front of and present real solutions for.
I think one of the other major issues is the uneasy relationship that exists between politics and big money and Wall Street, big pharma, and all the different aspects of that have concentrated lobbying interests in D.C.
Oh, yeah.
Trump is able to make the argument that...
Drain the swamp.
Right. Drain the swamp, and Barack Obama was going to bring transformational change. It had a lot of different aspects to it, and a lot of people thought changing Washington, D.C. was a big part of it as well. But the beast that is Washington, D.C. seems to continue to grow, and Trump also has this wink nod of, yeah, I may be corrupt, but I'm your guy. So and it's going to happen. It happens very much out in the open. And of course, the other aspect of this is Joe Biden and his son and that relationship and enriching oneself off of public office. So how do you ease people's concerns about the uneasy relationship between big money and politics? And what will be different about you as opposed to others who have enriched themselves?
I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is one of the biggest problems, probably the biggest problem in American life, where we all know that our government has been overrun by corporate interests and moneyed interests. And the problem is that the feedback is broken. It's like you don't really suffer any consequences if you're corrupt and self-serving in D.C. You just want to squat there and make as much money as you can, and what goes on in other parts of the country is secondary. Donald Trump was right to call for draining the swamp. There's a reason why Washington, D.C. is now the richest metropolitan area in the country, which is not the way it should be. And so a few things. Number one, I am now fourth in the polls, and I've gotten not one penny of corporate PAC money. It's all grassroots donations. My fans are even cheaper than Bernie's, because our average donation is only $24. Take that. And we're rising fast in the polls, in part because people can sense that I don't have any corporate donors to answer to. We're just going to do what's right. And the proposals I have to help break the stranglehold of corporate money, number one, I've already said that I would not take a dime of speaking fees after I leave office forever. Because the fact is, if you can get paid $250,000 to schmooze some corporate clients, you might be nicer to that company
right.
while you're president. You got to set a tone from the top. If you're going to change something, the president needs to say, look, I'll go first. The second thing is that running for president, even now, I see how people get corrupted, where the lobbyists are there with their checkbooks, and you get pulled in that direction at every turn. So the way we fight it, it's hard to get a rule in place that locks out the corporate money. It's like life in Jurassic Park, where like life finds a way.
Exactly, exactly.
The money will find
yes.
a way.
Yeah.
So the way we beat it is we actually tie the people and the money together. Now, how do you do that? What you do is you give every American $100 in democracy dollar vouchers that you can give to any campaign or candidate. This would flush out the lobbyist money by a factor of 8 to 1. The metaphor I use is that we have these government pipes that are just clogged full of money. You got to flush it out. This way, if I got 10,000 people in New Hampshire behind me, that would be $1 million. And then when the lobbyist comes with their $50,000 check, I say, screw you. I don't care about your check. That way you align our government interests with the people.
I think that there's obviously a lot of different things to talk about in this realm. But I think one of the other aspects of this is that we have Washington, D.C., which has become the central form of American government, where the federal form of government was supposed to be important, but there's supposed to be a decentralized aspect to it. You look as an example at the media contingency in Washington, D.C., where I just was on the Hill. There are hundreds of reporters that cover what happens on Capitol Hill, and we all know there's very little that happens on Capitol Hill
other than chasing
down senators and asking them about Donald Trump's tweet.
I talk to senators, and they're bored out of their minds because they're not actually passing any laws.
Right. So there's not much happening there. But meanwhile, here at the State House in Concord, there's two or three reporters covering what's happening at the State House. Few and fewer individuals covering city council, and a lot of that has to do with interest, and individuals aren't interested in what takes place.
You know, it's not just interest, Chris, it's just market incentives, where local journalism is dying.
Right.
We've had over 1,200 newspapers go out of business because they used to have classified ads and subscribers and then deliver hard copies. And
this is a really good point. It's a really good point about the fact that it's not just readership, but it's how the market has changed and the integration of, and media was behind in figuring out how to monetize and still is behind.
No, so here's the thing, man. Even what you just said, which is very much understandable because it's like American. It's like, hey, media has to figure it out. The fact is there is no market driver for local journalism in most communities.
Right.
And so you have to ask yourself, okay, do we think the market is correct on this one, or do you think you need local journalism for a functioning democracy? And it turns out that democracy functions much more poorly when no one knows what the heck is going on in their town. And this is one of the themes of my campaign, too, is like if you see a problem and you're like, all right, maybe we need a new solution to solve this problem that's not just letting all the papers die out. And so what I would suggest is that we find new ways of funding local papers out of town libraries, because everyone has a town has a library, or through nonprofits and philanthropy, where we start owning the facts. Like, look, if you don't have a local journalist covering things, then you don't know what's going on.
This is why I love your campaign. We disagree on a lot of the solutions, but the fact of the matter is that it is so important for when an individual says, this is wrong, I don't like this, this is a problem, for the individual to say, okay, well, this is what I want to do about it, or this is what I think we could do about it. Because very often in politics, and I think this is what turns people off, is that the political figure will just stand up and is running for president, and this is a problem right here. The wealthy control too much of our dollars. It doesn't trickle down, and then that's it. We got to do something about it. Leaders are supposed to push forth solutions and to have that conversation, and that's what I like about your campaign. Let's move into wealth tax. So you're tweeting about this, and I think this is important.
But I do want to continue your thought, which I completely agree that there is way too much attention and fascination with the machinations of D.C. The fact is, what goes on in D.C. should not have an overriding effect on your day-to-day life. You'd be better served by focusing on what's going on in your family, your household, your school, your town, 99% of the time than what's going on in D.C., and that's the way it should be.
That is Andrew Yang, Democratic candidate for president, joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. So Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been very much focused on a wealth tax. Bernie said that there should not be billionaires in our country. What are your feelings on that? Because to me, a hyper-focused tax on specific groups of individuals is going to create an environment where they're going to move their wealth around.
They're
going to
jet.
Right.
They're going to jet.
Or if you're going to, as I've mentioned with Bernie before, you're going to run out of billionaires one way or another sooner or later. And that's going to be a problem, because then what?
Yeah, I understand the spirit of it. In a way, it makes sense. Like, you have this incredible concentration of wealth in a smaller and smaller number of hands. And so you think, hey, we need to get some of that wealth back into the public coffers. But a wealth tax would be somewhere between problematic and disastrous in practice. You would see massive capital flight. You would see people getting fake divorced so that they'd get underneath the threshold, or all of a sudden their 18-year-old kid, like, you know, gets autonomy and then gets, or and why 18, 16, 15, whatever, and then just be like, hey, guess what? Now they get a quarter of my wealth. Like, you would see all sorts of craziness. And this has been proven out by the experience that other countries like Germany and France had when they adopted a wealth tax. You know what they did? They repealed it, because they found out that the implementation and compliance with it are hugely problematic and expensive and opaque, and it didn't end up generating the amount of money that you thought it would. So, you know, I understand the spirit of what Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are proposing, but in practice, it would be a real flop.
Ireland had a similar problem as well. So what do you do in order to create a more level playing field in regards to taxation?
Well, what you do is, first, you give the American people our fair share, a tiny slice of every Amazon sale, every Google search, every Facebook ad, every robot truck mile. Because right now, trillion-dollar tech company like Amazon's paying zero in taxes, even as it's closing 30% of New Hampshire stores and malls. And being a retail clerk's one of the most common jobs. The average retail clerk's a 39-year-old woman making between $9 and $11 an hour. Her store closes. Amazon's paying zero in taxes, and everyone's looking around like, where'd the money go? So number one is, you make sure that these megacorps, particularly the tech companies, pay back into the system. There's a study that just came out that said that our data is now worth more than oil. And one of the things I ask people here in New Hampshire is, do you remember getting your data check in the mail? No. Did it get lost? I'll tell you where it went. It went to Facebook. It went to Amazon. It went to these guys. So one way we have to reform our tax system is, we have to get ourselves some of the incredible gains of the 21st century economy into our hands and not be left holding the bag.
So how do you get them to pay that, though? Because they're going to say that the revenues aren't what you say they are.
Revenue is very hard to fake. And so when you look at other countries, you can fake a lot of, you can fake profits all day long. But it's very hard to fake revenues. And so when you look at what other countries have done, they've employed a value-added tax to harness those gains, and it would suck up the tech companies. The big innovation I have is that I want to take every dollar that we get and just give it to consumers, because to me, what we need to build is a trickle-up economy from people and families and communities up, and then trust that if we have this money, we'd spend it in the best ways possible for ourselves. And it's better for the market, it's better for entrepreneurship, it's better for small business. It even ends up helping the megacorps. It can create a virtuous cycle.
Final thing, how do you go about healing, you know, this nation and bringing people together? And I think this is one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest challenge, that our next president is going to have. You take the most recent whistleblower and a readout of the president's conversation, the president of Ukraine, and you have one side that looks at it and says, this right here is a smoking gun. You have another side that looks at it and says, there's nothing here at all. And then you have the middle that is wondering who is telling the truth and is mostly apathetic to what's taking place. So you have an apathetic middle, which is so important, because if in order to have a functioning democracy and to get back to the things we were talking about before, interest in state and local politics, you have to have a middle that's engaged, which may be the biggest problem of all. And then you have two sides who are yelling and screaming at each other about the same set of facts and seeing them completely differently.
Well, I'd consider myself to be someone who can hopefully bring us together. And as one sign of that, I'm one of only two candidates in the Democratic field that 10% or more of Donald Trump voters say they will support, which means that when I'm the nominee, we win in 2020 by bringing different people in from different parts of the political spectrum. That includes libertarians, independents, disaffected Trump voters, as well as Democrats and progressives. In a head-to-head with Donald Trump, I'm up 8 points here in New Hampshire because I'm drawing in people from different parts of the political spectrum. But, you know, I'll share something that one of my team members said to me that I thought was funny. There are a lot of videos of me on YouTube, and then someone said, if Andrew Yang can unify the YouTube comment section, he can definitely unify the United States. We have to bring people together, and I think that people sense that I'm just solutions-oriented, non-ideological. I'll take good ideas from anywhere. I will work with anyone who wants to solve the problems with me. And that, I believe, is the attitude that the country needs.
Andrew, as always, good to see you. Look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, I'll see you soon, Chris. Thank you.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. That is Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, Paul Steinhauser, and I talked with Tom Steyer, who called us over the phone from Iowa. Bernie, though, has been critical of billionaires and said the billionaires should not exist. And I'm curious, as a billionaire yourself, what your takeaways are from that and how you work those two things together.
Well, you know, I agree with Bernie that the inequality in our society is unacceptable, unjust, and undemocratic. I completely agree with that. And I believe that it, you know, I would attack it from both sides. I'm a huge believer that working people have been screwed for 40 years, and there's the data to back it up. And I think that, my argument on this whole thing is that there has been a corporate takeover of our government, hostile corporate takeover of our government, and that the critical thing for the American people to do is to recognize that and together for us to take back the government and recreate government of, by, and for the people. And that would involve not just working to make sure that every American has a living wage, that one job should be enough to live on, but also to undo the tax breaks that have been given to the richest Americans and to American corporations for the last 40 years. I think I was the first person in this race to recommend an asset-based tax on the richest Americans. But I agree with Bernie Sanders that the inequality here, both in terms of income and in the ways that the taxes favor the rich, has been absolutely wrong and should be addressed as soon as possible, immediately.
Tom, as we record this interview, we do it just a few hours after the two-year anniversary of that horrific shooting along the Las Vegas Strip, 58 killed, the worst mass shooting, the worst massacre in modern U.S. history. You put out a plan. Other candidates as well on Democratic sides have been putting out plans as we mark this anniversary. Are you concerned, though, that because of what's going on in Washington with the impeachment inquiry with the president underway, that issues like gun violence and some of the other top issues that have been talked about on the campaign trail are going to the wayside, not getting the attention they deserve?
In terms of the campaign, well, I look at gun violence, just so you guys know, as a classic example of this corporate takeover of our government. You know, this is not news that we have mass shootings in the United States. It's not news that we have gun-related deaths at multiples of any other advanced country. And the reason is that we've never addressed it. We don't have common-sense gun laws, is because the NRA is controlled by gun manufacturers who want to sell guns. And they've prevented Congress from taking any realistic steps, even down to background checks on gun purchases. So to me, this, over 90% of Americans have wanted that for decades. So I look at gun violence and I say this is a classic example of the corporate takeover of our government at the expense of the American people. And you ask me, do I think that impeachment is going to drown that out? look, I think people are going to talk about impeachment, but to me, impeachment, I've been talking to you guys about impeachment for a couple of years. I think impeachment is the proof of how this can work. The Need to Impeach campaign, which I started in 2017, got more than 8 million Americans to sign a petition to impeach and remove this president. This is a triumph of the grassroots over the broken system in Washington, D.C., basically forcing Washington to confront something deeply wrong, which is a criminal president. So to me, this is all one big question, you guys, which is, can the American people force a change in our government, this corporate takeover, get back to an effective government that works for them? And, you know, that's how I see impeachment.
That was Tom Steyer. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.